From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, major changes to a planned addition at the Milwaukee Art Museum will have exclusive details.
Whereas Quadracci Pavilion is white, whereas the Saarinen and Kaler additions are concrete, what could be done there that could be different yet be harmonious with all of those elements?
Then Aurora Healthcare finds an important niche for its new medical journal.
There are thousands of journals out there, medical and research journals. We couldn't find a medical research journal that had the word patient in it, which struck us rather odd.
Writer Jalee Johnson takes young readers to the steampunk era and the story of Madison writer Dale Kushner's novel, The Conditions of Love. Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The Milwaukee Art Museum made a splash last month when leaders unveiled plans for a new addition. But to many critics, the splash was kind of a belly flop. The design was criticized as being uninspired, the museum equivalent of a big box store, between the iconic Saarinen building and the Calatrava addition. It's also on prime public lakefront real estate. Added to that was the revelation that lead architect Jim Shields of HGA Architects had left the project. It all led to a firestorm of criticism, including from the Journal Sentinel art and architecture critic, who last week called for no new building at all for now. Fast forward to today, Milwaukee Art Museum director Dan Keegan joins Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio, along with architect Jim Shields, who has returned to the project with a revamped design. Keegan began by explaining what he believes any extension to the museum needs to accomplish.
Well, this is a very complicated project because the Milwaukee Art Museum is made up of three buildings. We're a campus of three buildings. The, of course, Quadracci Pavilion, designed by Santiago Calatrava, and then two older buildings that are owned by Milwaukee County. And because of the deferred maintenance issues of those two buildings, we had an opportunity. Some would see it as a major problem challenge. We saw it as an opportunity to partner with the county to make the repairs and make some important improvements and renovations to those older buildings that house the permanent collection. And the real opportunity that we saw relative to that small piece that we will be adding on the east end, which is really reopening the east entrance. I mean, that's kind of the headline news around that new piece of architecture that will be there. Many people remember the days years ago when you could park in the north parking lot alongside the War Memorial and come directly into the museum. And of course, over the years, that entire east facade of the Kaler addition has deteriorated greatly. It's been walled off. It leaks. The foundation leaks. So we see this as an opportunity to reactivate the east side of that important part of the museum's campus.
It also brings in more exhibition space, does it not?
It does in some significant ways. Not only will it add additional space for exhibiting the permanent collection, but up on the second level, there will be a very nice 4,000 square foot changing gallery space. So in addition to the large Baker Rowland Gallery in Quadracci Pavilion, we'll have an exhibition space about half that size to do other exhibitions.
Well, Jim, from the architect's standpoint, what were some of the biggest challenges in terms of creating something that works in that space?
I think the biggest challenge, and it's typical of most buildings actually, is a conflict between the internal demands of the building and its program and the site. And trying to reconcile those things is actually the biggest problem in our profession and the biggest obstacle to doing nice buildings. Things that can work in the inside, you put them on a particular site and you go, this doesn't work here. And so finding that right fit was a real challenge in this case. In particular, building on the lakefront, Milwaukee's hallowed ground, as it were, the most controversial place to build a building, finding a way to get this building that has a lot of exhibit space in it, or this east entrance, and make it work on that lakefront was a big challenge. And I think we found the ways.
Was one of the issues not competing with the Calatrava and with the Saarinen?
Definitely. Although I think that's easier than we had first thought it was. The Kaler wing, the 1970s expansion of the Saarinen, for example, it achieved a sort of low plinth or base like quality, a simple rectangular form, and basically we're able to sort of extrude that form as a simple rectangular volume, no higher than that base. It produces low linear horizontal lines that the Cairn and the Calatrava tower above.
When the reveal happened last month, there was almost immediate reaction all over social media. I don't think you can ever please everyone when it comes to a project like this. But, Dan, were you surprised or dismayed by some of the negative reactions that you were getting?
We know that there will always be criticisms to a new piece of architecture. I mean, architecture is one of the most impactful things in a community. I would say that we received a tremendous outpouring of support for the project and what we're trying to do. I think one of the most misunderstood pieces of releasing those images was that it was a very necessary next step in our design process to provide update to Milwaukee County supervisors and specifically the Parks and Culture Committee of Milwaukee County. And so we saw it as a kind of a skeleton in a way, an interim design that was showing the massing, a change from an east sort of atrium events-only space to one that is much more functional, much more interactive publicly with additional exhibition space. And so we of course, had to provide a necessary update on that without knowing what the exterior was going to look like exactly, what's the color of the building, what were the windows going to be like, and so on. And we knew that we would take some criticism at this juncture of it, but there's more design evolution to go and some brand new evolution, as you know, that I think will take care of a lot of those criticisms.
Well, Jim, one of the things that was going on at that time was news that you had left, but obviously now you're back. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, sure. I think that in any difficult project, and this is a very high level of difficulty in particular given the site, I think that the level of complexity of the project and the large number of people involved, you know, I think there's a dynamic tension that develops in any project between the internal needs of a building, between the needs of a site. And I think we reached a point where we might call it a rough spot where we had perhaps a bit much dynamic tension in the room, and I decided that it would be best at that time to step down from the design leadership role. I continued to engage with my team. I helped them with duct routing, for example, at one point. And I think the HGA and Milwaukee Art Museum continued to work on the project as a team. And within a month and a half or so, I think the we started getting conversations between HGA and Milwaukee Art Museum that suggested it was time for me to return to a leadership role. And I was very happy to do that, and it's been a great experience for the last 3 weeks.
Well, let's talk about some of those changes that have come out in the last 3 weeks. You sent over some pictures of those proposed changes. Can you talk me through what's different from what those – Dan, you were talking about the initial things that were released mm-hmm. on the 8th of April. What's changed?
Well, I think one thing that that we've been working on is the design that was released in April. It had one area where the upper story cantilevered out. But one of the things that we've worked on now is both on the north, east, and south to have this building cantilever out over the lakefront. And that's where the building overhangs the lake without any means of visible means of support. Columns are retreated into the building, and the upper building is protruding out. And I think this lends a sort of dynamic floating quality and also allows public space to sort of move through and under the building. And it's a kind of embracing gesture. It's also a notion that perhaps wave action has acted on this building to carve out or remove that first floor. And then that first floor has become all glass public space. That's something that didn't happen. There was some solid wall, quite a bit of it in that earlier design. Now the entire first floor is public space, open, transparent, so someone can go in, have a cup of coffee, and see Lake Michigan on a sub-zero day, which looks really cool, by the way. But most Milwaukeeans don't have a chance to see that. And now they would, sort of like a living room for the city. And I think these changes have really been positive.
My first impression of the photos was the idea that as I'm walking along – and which I do a lot, I run and walk and bike along there like a lot of folks do, is that I can see through that first floor now and I can see the Calatrava. Yeah.
Well, we thought that that was a very important development. We realized that there are the very practical things that are needed, the exhibition space, et cetera. But we did acknowledge that there are hundreds of thousands of people along the lakefront. And so the solution that HGA and Jim came up with we thought was brilliant, and that is to add an element of transparency and to take it one step further and not use glass that is opaque or black. If you look at the Kaler East Wall Edition today, that is black glass. You can't see in. So by using more transparency, by allowing for public to be in that space all along the entire first floor along that lake walk is something that was really, I think, a very powerful gesture about that welcoming sense that we want to convey with this smallish addition on the east end.
Is this version pretty final? I mean, I know things aren't final until they're built pretty much, but are we looking at what seems to be pretty solid?
I think so. You know, we have quite a few decisions to make, but not ones that'll substantially alter the image of the building. For example, we're talking about cladding this building in metal, a natural metal that would patina. So we've been looking, for example, at two metals that have a somewhat similar appearance, both a dark zinc, and we've been looking at a naturally weathered copper. And we're excited about these because, unlike most materials, these actually develop a patina. For example, the sarin and the Kaler out of concrete, they actually develop a weathered patina. It's not supposed to be super clean. There's some evidence of the passage of time and of age. The Calatrava, not so much. The Calatrava is supposed to be gleaming white with no patina upon it.
Pristine almost.
Right.
Yeah.
And so actually that's one aspect of contrast that we're after. We're joining the Saarinen and Kaler of buildings that are supposed to show weathering, supposed to show patina and the advance of time, while the Calatrava is forever gleaming. Hopefully if you can keep it clean, Dan, you know, good luck with that.
We'll do our best to keep it clean. I would add, I think one of the other breakthroughs in this design development was that the east entrance did not need to be white. That in fact it makes more sense for its coloration, its value to be tied to the Kaler edition and ultimately the Saarinen edition rather than Quadracci Pavilion, which is that beautiful gleaming white moment. It seems to make a lot more sense to pay attention to that weathering and aged concrete effect that Jim is describing and then to use a different material. Whereas Quadracci Pavilion is white, whereas the Saarinen and Kaler editions are concrete, what could be done there that could be different yet be harmonious with all of those elements? And I think HGA and Jim have come up with some very, very, very powerful solutions for this.
Do you see the actual landscaping changing around there very much, that actual walkway will be built differently or adjusted?
No, I think that we'd like to really maintain the walkway. The walkway was actually designed by internationally significant landscape architect Dan Kiley. One of the things he did there was he did a pair of locust trees with a beautiful white precast bench, and under the bench are lights that light the walk. And so there's this rhythm of double trees that marches down the lake walk. We think that that's a significant landscape by one of America's best landscape architects. He passed away, sadly, about 5-6 years ago, but it's one of his last works. So we're definitely going to be maintaining a master's work there. But I think we're going to have a bit of a courtyard in front of our building where we're proposing a grove of trees, not unlike the groves that Kiley produced in front of Milwaukee Art Museum or in front of Milwaukee's Performing Arts Center downtown by the river, a grove of trees in which people could sit out in chairs or tables and look at the lake from a slightly elevated position. So I think we're going to try to enrich that landscape and allow people to inhabit it on the lakefront. Mm-hmm. And it's currently just a broken concrete plaza from 1977.
Right. And then there's also kind of a sloped, grassy area, mm-hmm. too, in between mm-hmm. there. And there's a couple of sculptures. Will they stay?
Mm-hmm. It's a very important piece of this because we want to invite people to stay, to linger, to spend time outside as well as inside the museum. And so by design, There is a grassy area for those who want that. There is a patio area, and we envision tables and chairs and comfortable seating. There could even be some bench work that goes into that. Ultimately, this fits into, and I'm glad Jim mentioned the Kylie plan, because I too agree it's a very, very beautiful plan and very powerful along the lakefront. But we see next generation planning for the museum to include sculpture. What is the master plan going to look like once this is finished? And that circulation path that's created now of being able to come in an east entrance, to be able to enter on Quadracci Pavilion side, it allows us to think about all of the grounds of the building, all the way down to Michigan Avenue and that south piece of land, all the way up connecting to Veterans Park as a place where there could be sculpture as part of the museum experience.
So you're thinking of actually creating an outdoor sculpture garden?
Absolutely. Will be part of our master plan. In fact, I think we'll get through this repair and renovation phase, and we'll immediately go to work in thinking about what that master plan could look like, what the siting could be, et cetera.
And what pieces that you want to
include.
That's
the fun part that the curators get to have is, we'll probably identify key locator sites and opportunities for large monumental works as well as small niche pieces and then develop a plan for acquisition over time. Sculpture is expensive. It tends to be very permanent. So that will probably undergo a very careful process of thinking about acquisition.
Now, where are we in the process with the building? What's next?
Well, I think we would typically in a project like this one go through a series of developments from schematic design. And I would say that given the amount of work that's been done on the project, we're sort of in advanced schematic design moving into design development. And design development would be a phase and followed by construction documents. And then we're on schedule to be in the ground, so to speak, in September of this year.
So on track.
That's right.
And I would add from the dollars side of it, which is, of course, how everything gets built, it's a $25 million project minimally. We hope to raise a little bit more than that because we do have other things on our checklist and our wish list. The county, of course, has been a most generous contributor to this, recognizing that it owns the buildings and it has deferred maintenance, is putting in $10 million in repairs. We will raise at least $15 to $15.5 million to get this project completed. And we are on track. We are just over the $14 million mark with our fundraising, so we are well on our way. We hope to exceed goal. And I, too, feel that we will likely be putting the shovel in the ground come fall, early fall.
Jim, thank you so much for coming in and talking a bit about your side of the project. And Dan, of course, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
Dan Keegan is the director of the Milwaukee Art Museum. Jim Shields is principal at HGA Architects and the lead architect for the Milwaukee Art Museum's planned addition. There are links to renderings of the new design from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. There is also a public meeting to discuss the project in front of the Lakefront Development Advisory Commission this evening at 5:30 at O'Donnell Park's Miller Room. We also have an editor's note to pass along. We spoke with architecture critic Tom Bamberger, who had been outspoken in his criticism for the original design. That interview took place before the new design was revealed to us, so in the interest of fairness, we have invited him to appear on a subsequent show to comment on the new design. Aurora Healthcare has started publishing a new medical journal, one with a significant distinction. We'll find out what that is when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. We've had many Wisconsin researchers on this show for the contributions they've made to scientific journals. For medical researchers, that includes prestigious publications like the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association, and also specialty journals in various medical fields. One of the latest additions to the field of medical journals originates at Milwaukee-based Aurora Healthcare. The nonprofit medical group this year launched the peer-reviewed Journal of Patient-Centered Research. Randall Lambrecht is Senior Vice President of Aurora Healthcare and President of the Aurora Research Institute, and he joins us to talk about the significance of the new publication. Randy Lambrecht, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What's the significance of patient-centered research?
You know, the most important stakeholder in healthcare is a patient. And we at Aurora Healthcare know that that everything we do is centered around the patient. In fact, it's our model. So when we grew our research and formed the Aurora Research Institute about a year ago, we wanted to make sure that people understood the reason why we do research is to improve patient outcomes and lower the cost of healthcare. So we decided to focus on a sort of a saying that was patient-centered research.
Well, and this does not diminish the need for things like basic research, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, basic research plays into a lot of the research that we do, and it's the buzzword now is around translational research or translational science. So whether it's at the bench level, very basic, or whether it's more applied research, clinical trials, it has an aim of improving what we know about health, disease, patients.
Does that mean that that regardless of the subject matter and regardless of the research, the call is for the authors of that research to always have, you know, the ultimate outcome vis-a-vis the patient in mind as they put the paper together?
Well, it is a little bit at Aurora Healthcare. You might find a different sort of philosophy in universities or academic medical schools. We do some discovery work, but a lot of the discovery, you know, there's when you're at the discovery level, some things are going to work out and some things aren't. We're engaged more in research that has sort of passed a lot of the efficacy and a lot of the safety, and now we're evaluating it and developing it for actual translation into patient care.
Do you have an example you might be able to share?
Let me talk about a really important trial that I think has revolutionized cardiac care, and it's the aortic valve replacement trial. Now, this was an industry-sponsored trial, but it really is about how do you replace an aortic valve without cracking open the chest. And many patients who are very sick, they can't have their chest open. So this is a little valve that's sewn in a stent and tucked in a catheter, and it's fed up through an artery that can then be deployed over the deformed or valve that the patient that no longer functions well. And the outcome is tremendous. And this was a trial that we were one of the first to have in Milwaukee at Aurora, but now it's FDA approved. And it's a great example of how you can reduce the cost and improve patient outcomes, but something we wanted to get at Aurora right away.
Why publish a journal at all?
You know, it's a great question. And a few years ago, there was an article in the British Medical Journal about and it focused on NIH research, the National Institutes of Health, and how less than half of the projects funded by NIH ever saw the light of day in a publication. And in fact, it was even worse among the National Cancer Institute, where 40%, less than 40% of funded research got published. You know, there's an ethical responsibility, I think, that we feel to communicate the kind of research that we're doing, especially if it's publicly funded. But so we felt that, you know, whether it's really game-changing research or whether it's research that maybe didn't pan out the way it was hypothesized, that research has to be communicated. And so we felt an obligation as one of the largest healthcare systems, and we do a lot of research, to create an avenue to publish that and get it out there. So some of it's awareness, some of it's community education, but some of it's just sharing with other scientists and researchers and physicians the kind of research that we do.
Well, and do you think is the patient-centered niche how it fits in among all the other medical journals, either the general ones like JAMA and the New England Journal of Medicine and also the specialty journals?
Well, you know, when we were looking at a title for our journal, we wanted to make sure that we got the patient-centered message out there. And so we looked at the names of other journals, and there are thousands of journals out there, medical and research journals. We couldn't find a medical research journal that had the word patient in it, which struck us rather odd that there wasn't one out there. So the Journal of Patient-Centered Research and Reviews, I think, captures exactly what resonates well at Aurora, but it defines sort of our mission about the kind of research that we want to put in print.
The research that's being quantified here is patient-centered, but obviously your audience is generally medical professionals.
It's researchers, it's clinicians, physicians, nurses. It is multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary. But we also want to put it in the hands of, you know, the consumer is becoming quite savvy, especially the consumer who might have a condition that they – and so we wanted to put it out there for the general patient and consumer too. But it's really geared towards scientists and researchers.
How are you soliciting work?
We do it a number of ways. We have a website. We always have in our issues instructions to authors, and we invite manuscripts from all over. So we're using electronic media. We're using print media. In fact, the journal is really it's a quarterly online journal, but we print a number of copies each quarter. I sort of come from a generation that likes to have a hard copy in front of me. But we disseminate it to libraries all over the country. And it's interesting because our inaugural issue came out about a month ago, and we've gotten emails from all over the world. In fact, one of our scientific editors was invited to speak in China. So it's not just good for Aurora, but it's good for the Milwaukee community. It lets people know that there's exciting biomedical research occurring here. But we advertise it, and we invite manuscripts through all different forms.
So you invite manuscripts for work that's not it's not specifically work that's being done at Aurora.
Right. In fact, the inaugural issue I think had a couple articles from outside of Aurora, and the upcoming issue does too. It really does make a difference. And in fact, journals are rated by their impact factor, and their reputation is based on not just publishing work from a single organization, but from outside too.
This is a peer-reviewed journal. Is the review board just within Aurora, or do you have reviewers from outside as
well? We have reviewers from outside. So we have an editorial board. We have a scientific advisory board, and then we invite guest reviewers. That's a great question to ask, because when you're starting out with a new journal, you don't have that kind of reputation. And so one of the ways to get that reputation is to network and invite folks from the outside to participate in it. And so we're hoping that in a couple of years this journal is really well known and has that kind of impact that we want it to have.
The first issue focuses specifically on melanoma. Is the plan to feature work being done in a particular area for each issue?
Yeah. The journals will have thematic approaches, so every other issue will be a theme. So the issue that's coming out is sort of open to any kind of research. The issue that comes after that will focus on cardiovascular research. So every other one will have a theme.
And the first issue is already out. When is the next issue scheduled?
Next issue, I just saw the proof of it yesterday, and so we're making a few tweaks, but it will be out probably in about 3 weeks.
Well, very good. Randy Lambrecht, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Randy Lambrecht is president of the Aurora Research Institute and senior vice president of Aurora Healthcare. Aurora recently launched the peer-reviewed Journal of Patient-Centered Research. Another break now, and then a completely different kind of publication. Illinois writer Jalee Johnson joins us to share the story of a new middle grade fantasy novel. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Dystopian themes are common in fiction for young readers, and at first blush, it might seem like Piper, the heroine of Jalee Johnson's new middle grade novel, inhabits a dystopian world. But while Piper's circumstances are tough, her time is actually the industrial age in a fantasy world called Solace. The novel is called The Mark of the Dragonfly, and it opens as Piper has discovered an injured girl in the meteor fields outside her small scrapper town. It chronicles Piper's journey to help the girl, Anna, figure out who she is and where she came from. Jalee Johnson's journey to Milwaukee was an easier one. She made the trip up from Illinois to speak at classes in Elm Grove and New Berlin, and she stopped by our studio as well. Nice to meet you. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you've written novels in the past for a particular line of novels. There's a Dungeons and Dragons line of books that you've written for. But this one is a story entirely of your own making. How did you approach this novel differently than your other work?
The biggest difference in writing The Mark of the Dragonfly was that I got to create my own world from scratch, which was an amazing experience because I got to decide you know, it's a fantasy world. I got to decide what the magic was like. I got to decide the different species and creatures that inhabit it. I created a whole world guide for myself where I sketched a map and I had lists of the food and drink, the characters and species that appear in the world. So that was a whole lot of fun and very different from writing in an established world, which is what the Dungeons & Dragons line of books are.
Well, and being that it's a fantasy world, it's not even like taking an existing place like Milwaukee or Chicago and trying to make the characters work in it. You've set it in this world called Solace, which is Earth-like, but it is not Earth. How fleshed out did it have to be before you could set the characters in motion?
Well, I knew that I wanted a world that had echoes of Earth, had echoes of our own world. And I liked exploring the idea of Solace being a world where the boundary between other worlds was thin, where on certain nights these violent meteor storms would bring down these objects from other worlds, not just from our own world, objects we might recognize, but things that we wouldn't have any idea what they were, forgotten bits of technology, art, and literature. And I like the idea of putting them into this new world and wondering what the people there would think of these objects. How would they use them? How would they fix them up and make them their own?
Is that part of the enjoyment for you, is not only introducing your readers to these characters and hoping they get to know the people that inhabit these stories, but also they're discovering the world as they're reading along?
Absolutely. One of my favorite things growing up as a reader was reading fantasy novels, but any novel where the setting would sweep me away to a different place where I could see, you know, and touch and taste the world and really inhabit it. As a kid, I loved and was amazed at how authors could do that, could make me feel these emotions and feel the world. And I really wanted to develop that ability to do that for other readers.
As I was getting ready for this, I was trying to figure out the significance to your setting. And there's this subgenre of fantasy that I guess I wasn't really familiar with beforehand called steampunk. And
yes.
I wonder, obviously, if this is not, strictly speaking, a steampunk novel, it certainly has echoes of it. And I wonder how much that genre influences what you do.
It did influence it to a great degree, actually. I've been a fan of steampunk. And not just the idea of steam technology. I mean, obviously, there's the train, the steam engine that is a centerpiece of the book. But the idea of using these different technologies, I always say that the book is a combination of an industrial revolution and an age of exploration, because you have these two competing governments, one that wants to develop technology, airship technology, steam ocean steamers to explore unknown realms, and the other country who wants to develop weapons and take over, and the clash between these two governments and how it creates a class system and how the people are caught in the middle in this struggle and how they suffer. And I think that's a big component in steampunk as well, that idea of the common people, you know, struggling against these powers that are developing these technologies.
There are clues to the era in which it's taking place. I mean, your hero, Piper, is a scrapper. She lives in this village made up of people who collect debris that comes in on these meteor strikes. And there's a reference to a book that's found that looks suspiciously like The Wizard of Oz.
Yes. When I was playing with the idea of a time period, I was shooting for sort of a more, if you were to put it in Earth terms, it would be like a Victorian age. It would be the sort of the steampunk genre. But I took a few liberties here and there with the technology. I was picturing mid to late 1800s. I mean, obviously, I didn't want the technology to be too advanced. I didn't want the scrappers pulling out, you know, iPads from the from the meteor fields. So the technology is kind of more in Victorian times.
Well, let's talk about Piper. She is around the age of your audience, early teens, I guess. But she's a pretty self-sufficient girl for her age.
Yes, she is. She's had to grow up quickly, not only living in the scrap towns, but she's lost her father at the beginning of the novel, who's passed away working in a factory. And so she's really had to look out for herself and to try to survive. So that has definitely aged her beyond her years.
And the one thing that she is really, really good at that we learned fairly early on is she really has a way with machines.
Yes, she is. She's a talented machinist. In fact, she's the most talented machinist in her scrap town. The people of her village will bring her machines that have broken down that they've scavenged from the meteor fields, and they will have her fix them. She's so talented that she has a great reputation, and also some people can't believe that she's so talented that that she could make these machines work. They say that some machines will only work for her.
Well, and this is a good transition to the event that sets the story in motion. She's discovered an injured girl. What do we know about Anna as we meet her?
Anna is a very mysterious girl. In fact, when Piper first finds her, she thinks she's dead, that she's been killed in this meteor storm. But when she regains consciousness, she's completely disoriented. She doesn't know. She's lost her memory. She doesn't know who she is, where she comes from. And she gradually remembers her name. And the only distinctive feature about her is that she is marked. There's a mysterious tattoo on her arm of a dragonfly, which is an indication to Piper. She recognizes the symbol. It means that this girl is a very important person, that she's protected by the king of the dragonfly territories.
The two of them, Piper and Anna, find their way onto a train, the 401, in an effort to get to the capital of the dragonfly territories, Noveen, to presumably send Anna back to her home.
Yes. Piper believes that if she can help Anna get back to her home, regain her memory, she wants to help Anna, but she also sees an opportunity to maybe collect a reward for herself for getting Anna home, because she thinks if she's protected by the king that she has to come from a wealthy family. And if Piper can get a reward for bringing her home, then maybe she can pull herself out of the scrap towns and out of poverty and start a new life for herself.
But it does not take too long of being with Anna for her to be torn. Piper realizes that there's really more at stake to this mission she finds herself on than just the idea of getting a reward at the end of it.
Yes, she does. She determines very early on that not only is Anna an important person, but she's also a target. She's a target of some very, very nasty people who want her for their own reasons. She doesn't know what those are, but early on she develops a protective instinct towards Anna, and the two of them become friends. That was one of the things that I loved exploring with these two characters, is they are so very different and they have different motivations, but it doesn't take long for them to find common ground and for them to come together and want to help each other and save each other.
It's a real touching development that as their relationship develops. It really I thought that was one of the parts that was the most delightful about this.
Well, thank you. I loved writing, not only writing the banter back and forth between them, because they can fight like sisters and they have that relationship. But yes, just to see the development and the bond that grows stronger between them as the story goes along. It was one of my favorite parts of the writing.
And then the bond is affected as well because they face danger on this train. It's not just they don't get on the train and instantly find themselves in Noveen. They're under the protection of a fairly young boy named G, who also turns out not to be exactly what he seems.
G is a very mysterious presence. He's the protector and the guardian of the 401 train. He's part of its crew. He's been a part of the train crew for most of his life. It's his home. And at first, when Piper and Anna come on board, he sees them as a threat to the safety of his home. And so he wants to get rid of them as soon as possible. But again, as the story moves along and he sees what danger they're in and what risk, he also develops a protective instinct towards the two girls and wants to help them.
Well, so we don't want to give away too much in this book, but there is a certain amount of self-discovery that's at the heart of it, it seems.
Yes, it's very much discovering your identity, discovering what strengths you have, what powers you have to affect change in the world and to protect the people that you care about, and also coming to terms with the scary parts of who you are and accepting yourself. Yeah, I hope that came through in the book, because I really wanted that to be a part of the story in addition to the friendship and the working together.
What is it that appeals to you about the middle grade audience?
I like their sense of wonder. I have heard my writing described as kind of quirky, maybe a little bit romantic, maybe kind of odd. And kids, for whatever reason, seem to respond to that. They like the quirky characters. They like the the detailed fantasy worlds. They like to get lost in them. They like to have enough detail that their imaginations can fill in the rest. And it seems like we mesh well together as reader and author. So I like that.
Well, and I wondered if the middle grade audience is especially open to a fantasy world that perhaps older readers, it might just take a little bit more getting them into this place that they don't know.
Right. It seems like kids are much more – they're much more apt to join you on the journey. You know, they know that you'll explain enough about the world to, you know, have them centered, have them grounded, and then they're willing to – and they're eager to see the fantastical creatures that inhabit it or the way it's different from our own world. They're much more eager to jump on board with you.
Well, Jillie Johnson, the book is terrific. Thank you so much for spending some time and sharing it with us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Illinois writer Jillie Johnson's new middle grade novel is called The Mark of the Dragonfly. Johnson was in the Milwaukee area recently to talk to students at schools in Elm Grove and New Berlin, and she joined us then. It's an older audience for Dale Kushner's novel, The Conditions of Love. We'll hear about that book when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. The legend goes that the Eskimos have dozens of words for snow. Well, Madison author Dale Kushner thinks we should have more than one word for love in the English language. Her debut novel, The Conditions of Love, explores the many iterations of love from the perspective of the young protagonist, Eunice. As she struggles to discern what love is all about, she learns about the depths and limits of familial love, the importance of friendship and mentoring, and about passion, desire, devotion, and loyalty. The book is out in paperback today. Kushner told Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce last year that the book is written in three parts, the first of which focuses on Eunice's unique relationship with her mother, Myrne.
You know, one of the things that we all struggle with, and Eunice is struggling with in the first part of the novel, is this relationship with her mother, which is very intimate, very, very profound, but also her mother is, quote, a misfit. So she's also trying to separate from her mother, which is, of course, the goal of all of us. We have to separate from our parents. So she both adores her mother, who's a larger-than-life figure, but also resents her and also is trying to figure out her own identity. So you would hear a little bit of the mimicking, but as the novel progresses, you see that she develops her own voice.
And part of that comes as a reaction to her mother's relationships, her mother's own search for love, except when it's right in front of her, she doesn't seem to want it.
She doesn't seem to want it because she doesn't really know what love is. I mean, one of the aspects of the mother in this story is that she has an unfulfilled creative life. The novel's set in the 50s, and in the 50s, Hollywood was this place of pure enchantment. The mother, Myrne, has a fantasy life, a creative life about becoming a movie star. Well, if you're a movie star, the men that are going to flock to you are other movie stars. So she's always waiting for this sort of perfect lover, as in Clark Gable or Cary Grant. And so she can't really see what's in front of her. And this is not lost on the daughter.
I think that's especially clear when we see Eunice's dad come back into the picture ever so briefly, followed by the introduction of Sam Podesta.
Sam. Yes. Mm-hmm.
For Eunice, what do these two men represent?
Frankie is the charmer. Frankie is her father. He abandoned the family at birth. He's this charismatic man who becomes idealized because he's been absent for the first 10 years of her life. And he has that, you know, he has that bewitching blend. He carries that bewitching blend of charm and deceit, which is very alluring for a lot of women, including her mother. So he's that kind of man, the kind of man you would sort of drool over, but you know you're going to get your heart broken. Sam is a sort of a maternal figure. He's a stabilizing figure to some degree. He literally provides their groceries. he seems to be somewhat worldly, but he's also, the main thing about Sam is he's dependable, and she really knows he loves her. So again, these are facets of love that she's learning. The whole book is about an education about loving and conditions of loving, and do we give unconditional love to people, or what does that mean, or what can we expect?
Compare the mourning for us that Eunice goes through when it comes to having her father walk out on her a second time, having Sam Podesta leave her mother after Myrne rejects him, and mm-hmm. even losing Myrne as we get into the second part of the book.
The book is about loss. I mean, as a broad theme, the book is about how do we survive not only difficult beginnings. I mean, I often say Eunice was born under a dark star, but the challenges that face us along the way. And as much as we might want to sort of deny it, loss is part of living. Loss is part of the human condition. And Eunice gets a big wallop of it early on. It shapes her. And in my mind, she's a real heroine because she keeps her heart open and she doesn't become bitter. She doesn't seek revenge. She continues to love. So loss and love are very intertwined. And the wages of love often are that, you know, the more you love someone, the harder it is when you lose them. But do you choose not to love? I mean, that's a question I think we all face many, many times.
From the first part of the book into the second part of the book, you introduce this almost biblical flood that comes to the town Turtle Lake, where Myrne has taken Eunice to kind of start her life over again after Sam Podesta has left them. What does this flood, metaphorically, if you will, wash away and also wash into Eunice's life?
Well, obviously, floods are pretty mythic images. And we know them from the Bible, and even before the Judaic Christian Bible, there are Noah stories and other traditions. It is a washing away. It's also sometimes I believe crises give us the push to make choices, decisions, difficult decisions that we might not otherwise make. So in the situation of the flood, Eunice has been really wanting to separate from her mother, leave her mother in a way. And the flood gives her an opportunity, a physical opportunity to, well, she thinks she's going to go out in the flood and get help and rescue her mother. But in fact, it separates them. So it's a real transition, as these kinds of things are. If we think in reality, not metaphorically, about natural disasters, if we followed the stories of the people on the ground, whether it was a tornado or a flood or an earthquake, we might see that right afterwards there would be these big decisions that happen to families. So it is both metaphoric and literal in that sense. And it washes her into the next phase of education with a character named Rose.
Tell us a little bit about Rose and what she manages to give Eunice that she never could have gotten from Myrne.
You know, I've often, for people who haven't read the book, Rose is a kind of hermitess figure who lives in the woods, and she may seem very archetypal and mythical, and she is in a way, but she's also real because there are people, especially in Wisconsin and Minnesota and up north, these very strong woodswomen. So she has a reality to her. She provides Eunice with an understanding of friendship, with an understanding of loyalty, and also with a whole education about relationship to the natural world. So what I was going to say is sometimes if you don't get, quote, the right mother in real life, there's always Mother Nature. And I think that Rose represents something of that and introduces Eunice to an understanding and love of the natural world, which she was beginning to discover when she was with Myrne.
How is Eunice changing as we see her gain this appreciation for nature, gain a trade as she learns how to beekeep with Rose? How is she changing at this point in the story?
Well, one thing is she's learning how to live without her mother. She's learning she can live without her mother. And Rose, too, everybody in the novel, every character has a backstory about love. So she also learns from Rose, who seems, you know, so heroic, that Rose, in fact, has a backstory about love that's tragic and dark. So she learns from Rose that there's no perfection, really, in love, that love has many facets. And that, too, helps her to navigate what's ahead for her.
In the third part of the book, what sort of challenge is Eunice face? I mean, it seems like she's beginning to learn about a new kind of love.
She's learning about desire because she's a young woman and she has desire. And so everything that has come before her, the family, love of family, attachment to the parent surrogates, friendship, devotion, will now become part of her life in a new way with a man called Fox. And there's some tragedy ahead for both of them. But as she's learning and involved in this erotic relationship, really, she's also becomes an artist. She, all along in the book, she draws. That's one of the ways that her imagination works. And so from the beginning, there's sort of an elliptical pattern. She comes from a mother who has frustrated creativity, and in the end, she becomes an artist. And that's tied in with this man who sees that in her, who mirrors that in her, who feeds that in her. And so that's part of what she's learning in that last part.
Does Eunice ever really get a handle on how to deal with loss as it's related to love? How did her previous experiences prepare her for what she deals with Fox?
You know, I see her as someone who both suffers the loss, that is, she's not in denial, she doesn't put it into her work. I mean, all the many, many ways that we all try to avoid things that are painful, she kind of metabolizes it. She recognizes it. She cries. She may have, when she's younger, a way that she works it out through her imagination. But then she moves on. She cultivates things that bring her joy. She has an enormous sense of curiosity about life. She has an enormous sense of wonder, you know, especially the section of Rose when she's learning about the natural world. And I think that's the marker, I often think, of those who survive difficulties, loss, suffering, tragedy. They don't get stuck in the past.
Well, Dale Kushner, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Dale Kushner's novel is called The Conditions of Love. It's just out in paperback. Kushner, who lives in Madison, has received numerous honors and is also author of the poetry collection More Alive Than Lions Roaring. She talked with Stephanie Lecce last year. That's Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you along today, and I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.